Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Today, this program is another installment in a kind of a series that we've started here on WILL, a series that we're calling Will Connect, and the Will part, that's our call letters, WILL. It's a series in which we're trying to take a look at the local economy and what that's meant for the lives of people in East Central Illinois. Part of the idea also is to establish some connections between people and individuals and agencies and communities that are there to help people who need help. This grew out of a series of community conversations that we held this summer in Champaign and Vermilion and Macon counties. And what we did was we looked at some of the things that people said, tried to pick some issues from them, and then used that as the basis for conversations and also for news stories and features. And we put together a website, which is very much a work in progress, to sort of hold and bring together a lot of this kind of information, the results of the conversations, the programs we're doing here on Focus 580 will be on the Afternoon Magazine, all of our news features. And so at some point, you might want to take a look at that. It's willconnect.org/economy. That's the website. And this morning, our guest is Andre Arrington. He is the executive director of the Don Moyer Boys and Girls Club in Champaign, and he has had that job since 2001. His association with the Boys and Girls Clubs goes back some way. He was a member of the club in Birmingham, Alabama, and joined the club when he was 8. And since then, he's been involved in this movement for something like 18 years. His first job was for the club in Montgomery, Alabama, and then he went on to work in Boys and Girls Clubs in Memphis, Tennessee, and Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And before becoming executive director of the club in Champaign, he was the executive director of the Boys and Girls Club of Danville, in Danville, Illinois. So he's been involved with Boys and Girls Clubs for some time now. And one of the things we thought we could do was to talk a little bit not only about the club and what it does, but try to talk a little bit about how families with young children are doing in this economy that we're all kind of struggling with. So questions, comments certainly are welcome, too. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. There might be some people who are not familiar with the whole idea of the Boys and Girls Club. You want to talk a little bit about just what kind of place it is?
Sure. The Boys and Girls Club is a year-round program that we focus on youth development. And we're not a school. We're not a recreation department. Basically, kids come in because of either referral of a parent, friend, most of the time because their friends are members of the club. Mm-hmm. And the kids come in to get assistance with homework assistance. We try to broaden their exposure through different activities and programs such as smart moves, you know, how to keep kids away from drugs, alcohol, teenage pregnancy, tobacco resistance. Then we also do field trips to, like, the various museums, science and industry, Spurlock Museum here in town. And that's just to get kids exposure to avenues and opportunities that may not present themselves. Focus a lot around life skills around how to protect yourself over the Internet, since the Internet is a big major tool. We have two computer labs. Right now, you know, a vast majority of our kids, around 81%, is lower socioeconomic. So that digital divide is a reality, mm-hmm. in regards to having high-speed Internet access at home or having the latest state-of-the-art technology. So we have those tools in our clubhouse. So kids during the school year and year-round have access and work on their technological skills. But during the school year, like getting reports done, we have a color printer, so kids need to get charts and things like that. May not have a color printer at home. Mm-hmm. So to make sure that we have the resources available for kids that need us most. The other thing that really keys into the topic of today, we have a lot of working class families, and those parents choose us because we have transportation programs from school into home. And that kind of gives the foster parent or the single parent of three some break in their day, and it gives them some relief.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure that there are a lot of parents who really value the club because they know this is a safe place for their kids to be and that there are a wide range of activities for them. They can do sports. They can get some mentoring. They can work on their homework. They can do make a real constructive use of their time in a place that's safe where there's they're caring adults also that can be involved in their lives too. And, I'm sure that in a time like the time that we're having now, this gets to be even more valuable, particularly if parents are having to spend more time working, whether you have a one-parent family, two-parent family. You know, there's probably a lot of times when parents are just really working very hard, and this way they don't have to be quite so worried about how their kids are spending their time.
That's correct. A lot of parents select us because of the holistic aspect in which we focus on around our services. We try to factor in from getting a kid, removing the barrier of transportation and access, all the way to making sure that we feed them with a healthy meal or a snack, and as well as we feed them with a spiritual and emotional developments aspect. So we become, a lot of anecdotal facts about Boys and Girls Club was pulled together, and it's called Lessons of Hope, and that's one of the lessons is a lesson of family. You know, we have a family wholesome environment for kids.
So, right at this moment, how many members are there in the club?
In 2008, we served a little over 1,500 kids, 1,521 to be exact. We have grown between 12 and 20% since 2005.
So that's pretty impressive growth over just a period of, four years. Have you, you know, I guess what we wanted to do was to talk a little bit about where we are now. In your getting to know these kids and perhaps getting to know their families, what sort of stories do you hear about the kind of challenges that people are having to deal with these days?
Well, it varies because we have such a diverse background of families and kids that come to us. We have from extreme poverty to families that are pretty well and stable and they, you know, two parents working and everything. Mm-hmm. But everyone comes for a different reason. Some of the families that come that may have the more what we perceive to be a more well-established family environment, they want their kids to be around diversity. They want their kids to be in a diverse environment. They want the in diversity not just from a ethnic standpoint, but also kids that are socioeconomically diverse. We have some parents because we're open when schools are closed. Mm-hmm. So we only close about 4 weeks out of the year. So the parents know that if their kid is in year-round, the club is available for them. Summertime, we run a 10-week summer program. We just finished on August 14th, and since school is opening a little earlier, we're reopening up on the 24th. Champaign starts today, and Urbana starts Monday. So we'll be ready for parents. Today's a half day. Today and tomorrow's a half day for Champaign. So when there's no school during the school year, we open at 7 a.m. And so for the families, the parents that have to get to work, be there by 8 o'clock, they can drop their kids off between 7 and 7:30, between 7 and 8, and we're there. Last year, we created a program for the year-round kids. So when they're in their intersession breaks, that we're available for families as well. Yeah. And the whole premise is to keep cost affordable. And so we're not a fee-for-service program, but we do have nominal fees such as like for field trips. You know, we ask the families to cover the cost. But sometimes, I mean, it doesn't cover staff time. It doesn't cover transportation and all those things. So, I mean, there's a lot of other fixed overhead costs that goes into the program that, you know, we don't pass those on to our customers as in the business world you hear all the time.
Yeah. How many staff do you have?
Well, part-time staff, we fluctuate between 15 to probably 25, depending on the demand of the kids. Our ADA for after school last year was average daily attendance, that is 100, was 121. Last summer, we was 141. This is 2008. To give you an example, for July, our average daily attendance was 187.
And how does that compare with, say, the same time last year?
Well, we're still crunching the numbers, so I don't have all the summer data. It was a very aggressive summer. Give you a kind of snapshot of our summer. Our day starts at 7 a.m. Mm-hmm. Then 5 o'clock, day camp ends. And then 6 o'clock, we all have a teen night program, and that's Tuesday through Friday. Day camp is Monday through Friday. And what occurs at teen night, we're trying to capture kids that, keep them off the street, keep them engaged in some positive activities. So it ranged from cooking classes to basketball to we have some female-specific programs, kids playing Wii, kids just hanging out in the games room. There's just a variety of things, just trying to capture. And then we have dances on Friday nights for the kids. We had a pool party over at Sholem Pool. This summer was the best Tuesday through Thursday from an average daily attendance. We averaged about 67 to 75 kids a night. Okay. The Friday nights normally spike up because, you know, it's a dance and kids from all over normally come. But what we were seeing was kids really wanted to have a place to go every evening. Last year, because of budget constraints, we had to cut back on our teen services. And one of our teen grants was cut this year, which with the state. So we're trying to find a way we're stretching resources to the possible end to keep the same format we had for the summer, not keeping the club open until 11 o'clock, but going till 9 o'clock. But it'll be with fewer staff. So we're trying to find volunteers and partner up with, university groups and, church groups so we can keep an environment going for kids.
Yeah. You're a nonprofit organization.
Absolutely.
Where does most of your funding come from?
Well, from a variety of sources here. From government, and that's being slashed constantly. In 2008, 35% of our funding came from government, and that's out of $870,000. United Way represents 17% of our budget. And individuals, donors represent about 23%. In corporations, about 8%. And special events, 9%. So that kind of gives you a little snapshot of the large pieces of our pie, in regards to our funding.
Well, I talked about the fact that earlier this summer we were having these conversations in some communities around our part of the state. And one of the things that we heard at that point, over and over again from a lot of different people was, for those organizations like yours that get state and federal money, particularly state money, people were really worried. And at this point, Illinois didn't have a budget.
That's correct.
And we do now, although there's still a lot of uncertainty.
Yes.
About where money will be allocated. And I think that at this point, and this was back in June, there were a lot of people who were worried about what was going to happen with their funding. How much would they get? Would they get anything? I think there were some social service organizations, nonprofits who really depended on state money who were worried they might actually just have to close the door.
Yeah.
They just wouldn't have the money to operate.
That's right.
And now, how do things look now?
Not much better, to be quite honest, because, for example, most people are hearing 75 to 65% of funding to be restored. Lucky to get 85. But I think we have to keep in mind most of these dollars have been flat for the past 5 to sometimes 10 years. Okay, there has not been any cost of living increases with these dollars. The rate of inflation has skyrocketed around us. Things like fuel, waste disposal, utilities, health insurance, all these things, we're still impacted from a business model standpoint. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times where people get us a little confused, meaning nonprofits or the human service sector, is that we are immune to business taxes. Only thing we do not pay is sales tax. Okay, that's really it. Everything else I have to pay in property tax on your property. I have to pay payroll taxes. I have to, when health insurance go up, we have to pay the difference of it. We do not get breaks with surcharges. When surcharges are applied on our waste disposal, they do not send us that bill. They send us that bill with the same language that all businesses have. Fuel tax, when fuel goes up, we have to pay it. So we're in the economy with everyone else. There's really only two luxuries. That's property tax and sales tax, and when we purchase goods. So there was a unit in Springfield that did close because it had so much restricted funding, Boys and Girls Club unit. Mm-hmm. There was a Boys and Girls Club in East St. Louis that closed because it had so much restricted funding. We started trying to diversify ourselves in 2001. We were very lopsided with how much state funding we had. Now, we still need those dollars to do the more aggressive programming when we start talking about tracking kids, and we need that expansion of staff. And, it'd be very challenging to raise that type of money locally in your community. So that's where the state dollars are supportive. But when you're not getting your reimbursements in a timely manner, then that means you have your payables, your vendors, you can't pay them in a timely manner. And it just becomes a trickle-down effect. So right now we lost $125,000 on a grant for teens, our Teen Reach grant. I'll go to a meeting next week to hear, what's the status of that grant. Via email, I've heard 75% restoration of funding. However, the grant has changed significantly. The demands and expectations has changed 125%. So more expectation is placed upon me, but I get less money, which was already a flat dollar, which was actually a diminished dollar. Mm-hmm. So the dollar I got in 2001 doesn't have the same value that it has in 2009.
You know, I think also people who don't work in this field, I think, don't really understand just how complicated the business of working with a governmental grant is. Okay. That it's not just the case where somebody comes along and hands you a check and says, here's your money, good luck.
Right.
What you have to go through to qualify,
right,
is very complicated, and you have to be able to demonstrate that you used it in the way that it was intended. And so you have to be able to show, yes, here's what we did, here's how we spent the money. And it's a tremendously complicated thing. And I'm sure that it's the kind of thing that takes up hours and hours and hours of many people's time, just making sure that all the paperwork is correct.
That's correct.
And that you're abiding by all of the various requirements that are attached that come with that money.
That's correct. Compliance is a major variable. And that's what we're talking about when I said they've increased the expectations, by 125%. Well, now you're trying to figure into your business plan how you can retain these dollars because you know you need them. Mm-hmm. But at the same token, every time our payroll increases, well, we increase our workman's comp rate. We increase our unemployment tax rate. I mean, there are so many other variables. And then you have more, pension is in effect. You have, the health care costs. So when you get through with all of that, you always need more money than what you started out with or what you was awarded. Mm-hmm. And then you're still trying to figure out how do I stay in compliant just on the delivery side of things. So you have the business model that you're trying to juggle and to stay compliant. And then you have the program side of compliance that you're trying to juggle. And And for nonprofits, it's far better for, you know, as a society that we do it in a private sector versus in the public sector, because if government was trying to do this, well, the way regulations are, they're going to get their cost of living increases. You know, it's just going to – it costs more. I mean, we use a computer until it just crashes. But if we were in a state institution, it would probably be recycled every 3 to 5 years. Yeah, we replace computers probably every 8 years. Okay, like we're now replacing some computers in our office, and I mean, they were slow, or the monitors were just blinking. You know, people are trying to type in between as the monitors flicking. You know, but you're trying to be good stewards of your resources. And you're trying to stretch everything out to the nth degree. Yeah.
Our guest, let me just introduce here, is Andre Arrington. He's the executive director of the Don Moyer Boys and Girls Club in Champaign. He's had that position since 2001. Before that, he was executive director of the Don Moyer Boys and Girls Club of the Boys and Girls Club in Danville, Illinois. And he's actually been working with the Boys and Girls Clubs for a long time. He's worked in clubs in Montgomery, Alabama, in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, also in Memphis, Tennessee. And we're talking about something about how the club works, who they're trying to serve, and maybe some of the challenges that nonprofits like his face in trying to meet the needs of all of the people who and all the kids and all the families who would like to be involved. Questions, by the way, are welcome. Questions, comments, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about how for you it's been a really robust summer. That is, you had lots and lots of kids who wanted to come down and be in the club. And also you've talked about the funding situation. And here you've talked just a little bit about how basically you you make do. You work with what you can. But I guess I'm still kind of wondering, you know, well, what you do, you know, the number of kids who are coming through the door goes up. You know your dollars are down. At one point, maybe you're not even sure what you're going to get. What do you do to cope with that kind of situation?
What we do, first of all, is we start off with a waiting list. We set a goal of to average 120 kids. That's our truly what our real capacity is. Mm-hmm. So we slot off. We say, okay, X number of 6 to 8 year olds we can register. X number of 9 to 10 year olds, et cetera, et cetera. So that because we're on an operational model, not a fee for service model. We do not get for every 6 year old, we get $10 a head. We don't get that. We're not Medicaid. We don't receive Medicaid funding or anything like that. So we look at what our capacity is, and then we look at what are we mandated by our funding sources to provide. So then we're looking at making sure that we stay compliant and we meet all of the deliverables. It's a first come served basis at that point. So let's say if we take 26 to 8 year olds, if you are a parent 21, we put you on the waiting list. But the reality of it is, we're going to try to get back to you as soon as possible. First, we want to make sure we have enough staff, because most of our staff is part time and volunteers, that they all come through. We don't want to have 120 people and we only got 2 staff members in the building. So once we know and establish where our staff is and what the capacity holds up, then we will start letting kids come off of that waiting list. It's extremely challenging, put in perspective. In that 10-week summer program, we enrolled 673 kids. That's how many, at least one kid came through that door one time over a 10-week period. And it could be where, let's say, we get things like new family comes to town, work at Carl, and the family hasn't established all of, you know, one parent is here, they want to get the kids in school. So the kid may be coming to the club for a week, okay, or 2 weeks or 3. So we get some situational circumstances as well that we have to deal with. But once again, we try to establish our base of 120 when we first start off, and we register kids accordingly. But we very soon start letting kids off that waiting list because parents and families need those services.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned it a little bit a couple of times here, these conversations, these community conversations we had earlier in the summer. And, you know, one of the ideas here was to try to get a handle on how people were doing in these communities and also to get people talking about, well, what was really on their minds, what concerned them, you know, to have them talk about their communities and things that they thought were good about them and, you know, maybe things that they thought were problematic. And it's real clear one of the things that people are concerned about is they're concerned about children and
yes.
their future and they're particularly concerned about teenagers.
Yes.
They're wanting to have for them something constructive to do with their time and not to get into trouble. And it just it seems to me that we don't have enough opportunities like this, like what you all have to, you know, to offer some constructive and not just a place to go. But again, I think what's really important is an opportunity for not only kids to interact with each other and kids who are different,
mm-hmm. yeah.
but also for kids to interact with adults.
Yes.
Who are not their parents or their family members or maybe their teachers, you
yes.
know. To interact with some adults who are caring folks. That again, seems a real important opportunity and one that these kinds of opportunities, they seem to be shrinking, you know.
Yes and no. I think there are a lot of opportunities out there, but can these opportunities sustain themselves?
Yeah.
I go to meetings. There's a lot of mentoring programs, but thinking of it is, can we sustain everything? That's what the challenge is. I mean, we have been fighting, scraping, revising just to try to keep our doors open. I think what we really have to think about as a community is what would our community look like if we did not have the social service sector? If the time center closed, where would all those displaced men go? Where would all of the families go at Urban Restoration? Where would all of the kids from the Boys and Girls Club and the YMCA go? Indian Acres. And the reason why I touched on those, I mean, each one of these entities serve a different sector of the community. So it's a major resource and a valuable asset to have a diverse set of services. We have to really understand that in order for those services to sustain themselves, there has to be resources there to keep them going. I mean, the Windsor Club closed out on Windsor Road in East Urbana.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's not a lot to do in East Urbana for families. And, you know, we send vans out to East Urbana now picking up kids. Prairie School is one of our largest schools in which we bring kids in an after-school program. You know, that's a void. And yes, it's kind of like if there are two grocery stores on the same street, if one closes, well then you can go to the other grocery store. But if both close, now you got to find somewhere to get your groceries.
Yeah.
So Windsor Club closed. Okay, well, you can go to the Boys and Girls Club, you can go to Indian Acres, you can go to YMCA, you can go some other places. But if two or three more of those other institutions close, now your options are dwindling. And then I haven't heard anyone say that they were not at capacity. So I think that's the other thing, you know. Programs, you know, these programs are not, you know, just sitting around. There's someone, you know, with their feet up. Waiting on some kids to come through the door. You know, our programs are at capacity. I mean, we're really running above capacity. You know, we have to be cognitive of that.
Yeah. I would guess, I mean, I don't know, but I would guess that if we talk to some of the people who in the other organizations that you cite, they would probably say the same thing.
Correct.
That they're also running at capacity and that and I'm sure that there are you know, some organizations like yours that's pretty good size, or, you know, maybe the Developmental Services Center is maybe one of the biggest in Champaign County. I would bet it might actually be the biggest.
Yes, sir.
And they've had to cut back significantly on the number of people that they can serve. And I'm sure that there are also then smaller organizations,
that's right,
not less important, but smaller in terms of their staff and their resources.
That's right.
You know, I'm sure they get to the point where you can't cut anything more and still actually be able to render some service. So I'm sure that it's more difficult for a smaller organization, because you get to the point where you can't cut anything more, and you just have to say, well, we're just going to have to close the door because we don't have the resources to really to do what we really feel we need to do and want to do.
That's correct. I mean, you could only shrink but so much. I mean, at some point in time, if you shrink too much, well, you built an infrastructure based upon that organizational model. And if you were to shrink too far, either you're going to be lopsided, whether your administrative to program services are going to be distorted. You know, you really want to be around 70% of your dollars going towards program services. But if you shrink to the point where you keep your infrastructure but you take away from your program structure, well, then you can't provide services. Well, if you take away from your administrative infrastructure, you can't stay compliant. And then people say, oh, well, you know, they mismanaged money. No, they didn't have the proper resources to be compliant from audits and accounting. You know, so, and you may put a program person that may not have, they may be extremely talented around programming, but not extremely talented around administrative services. So you've put them in an uncomfortable environment and in a situation to fail. And so it's just like any other business. You wouldn't put the someone that's not a trained radio personality behind the microphone and expect for them to do this on a daily basis, you know, and thrive and succeed. Mm-hmm. It is not what they're trained to do. But if they're trained to run programming but not trained to do debits and credits, we all have gifts, and you know, not many of us can do them all.
Well, you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that you do receive some funding from United Way and from individual contributions. And I suppose that some people would ask, well, if the funding that you're receiving from the state of Illinois or from the federal government, from government, if that shrinks, how much could you expect that contributions from individuals, whether you would get them, say, through the route of United Way or just from somebody who would say, I want to support the Boys and Girls Club, how much could you expect those kinds of contributions to make up for loss of the state and federal dollars?
Well, I have to look at it in the context of the broader picture, because United Way doesn't support one agency. And I would say it'd be very hard for them to assist all of us to replace all of the dollars that all of us have lost. I mean, Dale has lost millions of dollars in developmental services.
Yeah, yeah.
So he probably, I mean, there's no way. The answer to the question is there's no way. United Way cannot replace all of the dollars that all the agencies would have lost. But in saying that, what that does is that put all of us back in the marketplace to try to raise dollars in the community, in which the United Way concept was to have the community chests and, you know, that will serve the social service needs. I mean, of course, that was many, many, many years ago. And as over time, you know, things have expanded, costs have gone up. But that's still the core basis, because every business has to have cash flow. And United Way pays in 1/12. The county funding comes in 1/12 or in a reimbursement format. And the state funding comes in 1/12 or in a reimbursement format. So you have constant cash flow in some way. Fundraising doesn't go that way. Fundraising is kind of, it spikes. You know, it would be up, down, peaks and valleys. You know, everyone would love to have a fundraiser every day so you could try to raise money every day. But that's just not the reality. It does take a continuum of funding and cash flow, just like for every business. You know, our bills roll in every day and our expenses are every month. So you need to have a certain amount of cash flow to balance you and get you through.
Yeah, and I'm sure that it's tough for a lot of people who are getting some of their money from the state, mm-hmm. because the state's not paying its bills on time. And you know, it could be that the state would say, you know, well, I know you were expecting a check from us this month, but I'm sorry, we're a little strapped. So maybe
that's right.
Maybe we'll send you your check next month. So, you know, that's pretty tough because you can't tell the power company, well, you know,
that's right.
We got the bill here, but we're a little strapped, so maybe we'll pay you next month. Well, the power company's not gonna go.
That's right. That's correct. And once again, you know, nonprofits do not get any other break than any other business. You don't pay your power bill, they're gonna turn your power off.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do business without power. You're absolutely right. It's the cash flow that's so important and what these grants bring to the table. So you can kind of clean up your payables with your fundraisers and things like that and keep things going. But if it was a month off, we'd really be doing good. I'll give you an example. We just got a check from the state for March and April.
Just now you're getting the check for March and
April. Yes. So if it was just a month or two, I would be jumping up and down right now. So that meant we had to restrict our programming, our infrastructure. So like, we worked without one program director all year. Okay. But then you had to find the personnel that was not tied to a grant that you could take out. Because if the grant requires you to have someone, you got to have someone. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because then you're out of compliance. You'll be telling them that you're billing them for something that you don't have. So you had to find that employee or part-time people that are not tied to some funding source that you could take out of the equation and still function. So so we were able to do that and to live. However, we had to bring in a temporary person for the summer because we knew we was going to be, you know, with a day of starting at 7 a.m. and ending at 11. We had to bring someone in that would not, we just didn't have burnout. I mean, at that point, it would be illogical for me to expect for my full-time salary people to work from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. I had to find a way to give them some breaks in between. So, you know, you have to do, you know, things like that. We are looking at how do we improve our fundraising. I mean, we always have to look at that. It's just a constant analysis of operations, constant analysis of cost savings. Like right now, I'm leaning on my peers and my friends and my network to come in and do staff training. So we don't pay for staff training, you know. But staff has to have development. They got to have, you know, get some reassurance about what they're doing, to get some new ideas about it. So instead of me paying for three or four people to go somewhere else, we're doing a lot of job shadowing, you know, sending mm-hmm. people to other Boys and Girls Club, borrowing some ideas. But that means I'm taking them out of my operations and I'm two people down. Well, I was already maybe four people down. So now I'm six people down in actuality. But you got to juggle and give people, so you got to show people that they're valued and that, you know, without any of these businesses, you know, WILL could not exist without you guys working here. And we're the same way. Mm-hmm. And everybody has to have continual education and training. And so we're trying to do as many creative things as possible to get people value, show them that we appreciate them, but then also get them the resources that they need.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580, Andre Erringson, he's the executive director of the Don Moyer Boys and Girls Club in Champaign, has had that job since 2001. Before that, was the executive director of the Boys and Girls Club in Danville and has been involved in this organization, Boys and Girls Clubs, for quite a long time. We have a caller here who'd like to bring into the conversation. Other folks are certainly welcome. We have maybe about 10 minutes left in this part of the show. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's someone to talk with in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of services for youth, and I'm thinking specifically for Champaign. And I know that there are services for youth, at least theoretically, through Douglas Park, supported by the Park District. And I know there's this great big project in Garden Hills, which I think is supported financially, what, School District, City of Champaign, and the Park District. You don't have access to any of those public funds other than state public grants? Question mark.
Good question, caller. The Garden Hills Project was a redistribution of funding.
Right.
That used to be went to several agencies, DSE. Now, we're still in the Garden Hills Project.
Oh, you are, okay.
Yeah, but let's kind of put it in context, though. We were receiving $20,000 through the city allocation. And then the Garden Hills Project, so we received 10. So now we only get 10. So we have a net loss of $10,000.
Half.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
So, and let's say if they shift priorities again, we could lose 100%. And that's one of the other things that, you know, how trends go. Give you another example. Corporations, you know, craft. We're not a heavy corporate laden community. But craft corporate changed their giving structure. They used to do outright gifts, and then they went to a grant structure. And so we were in the grant structure. Now they went to this volunteer process. Well, we were getting $13,000, myself, DSC, and several other agencies. Well, now we get zero. So, and although we're talking about state and federal and government funding, there's a lot of other changes in the landscape because corporations give the least amount of money in regards to the full, when you look at a philanthropy chart. The greatest amount of giving comes from individuals. Over 77% every year, the numbers, and we're talking billions of dollars. So the municipalities and as, you know, as constituents see a different need, you know, there's a finite amount of money.
Absolutely.
And so therefore, when you hear about things being new programs, the question as an individual, as a citizen, you have to say, it may be a new program, but it may not be. It's not, 9 times out of 10, it's not new money. Someone else's money was taken away.
Right.
And so that was a shift there. So the Garden Hills Project, great project. You know, we still serve kids from Garden Hills and as well as other segments of the community. But in a net dollar, we lost money versus gaining money. And some people were not as fortunate. They just lost 100% of money.
Yeah.
And so your other one was about Douglas Park. That's the Park District, and they do run programs there. But the Park District is a different funding stream. They're their own tax-based entity. And so their funding stays within their programs and services.
And they do not help support any other programs outside of the Park District programs then. Is that true?
Well, they partner, you know.
Okay.
They partner with other agencies. But it's pretty much, I don't know how to say this, but it would be, I can't take my money and lend it or borrow it to another nonprofit.
Right.
Okay. So that would be out of bounds from a compliance standpoint. So we can partner with things, which we do. Like I said, we had pool party at Sholem Pool and things like that. And so, but the Park District can't not take their money and to fund the Boys and Girls Club.
Okay.
Or any other institution.
Okay. Thank you.
All right,
yes, ma'am.
I expect that being as, you know, Champaign-Urbana is a relatively small town, that people who work in the social service sector, that you all, I expect you all probably know each other pretty well. You know people who run other organizations, and I'm sure that you all from time to time, either you bump into each other on the street or for whatever, you know, you get together and you talk about how things are going.
Yes.
the kind of things that you here have been talking about specifically with in connection with the Boys and Girls Club, I guess I want to make sure that people understand that all kinds of organizations, you talked about the fact that they're different organizations, they have different missions, and they serve different kinds of people,
right.
That everybody is pretty much in the same place.
Yes.
As far as increased demand, decreased funding, and meeting this challenge of, how are we going to continue to try to do our mission, serve the people that we want, when there are more of them coming in the door and that there are fewer dollars to do it.
Absolutely. I'll give you an example. During the summer times, we service a lot of kids from Rantoul through our team program. We send vehicles up to Rantoul and we bring them back. Well, we were bringing in 20 to 30 kids a night. Well, staff come to me and say, we really like to continue that. You don't want to discourage them, but you say, okay, if we can figure it out, we have to put the onus now back to creativity and ingenuity. Due to the fact that I do not have a line item that I could just say, okay, we have $40,000 to transport kids to and from Rantoul. We're already going to be working off of, a great deal of volunteer-based man hours. Mm-hmm. Now, we may come up with something. We've been very fortunate to be very creative in a partnership to come into place. Right now, that is a major challenge for me to figure out. How do we continue that? Is there a demand or a need? Absolutely. But then, we factor in weather comes in wintertime and, 45 is not the best road. And, there's a lot of risk factors. There's just a whole host of things. But our staff's supposed to be thinking about how can they reach as many kids wherever they are as often as they can. Mm-hmm. That's their charge. But the reality of it is there's only so many things that we can do. And, time constraints, getting kids back home. But there's a definite need, for us to do that. So continuing of services, how do you sustain them and keep them going is always something that you're juggling and trying to keep in place.
Let's talk with somebody else. We have someone here on cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi. Simple question, but a question and a comment, I guess. Question is, it sounds like a lot of the talk is about funding, and you probably accept just donations from the public in the form of either cash or materials, I don't know. If so, what's the easiest way to make a donation? And two, I'm not sure that this would affect your organization, but there was a great This American Life about a program with, new funding from the Obama administration. And this had more to do with really young kids and feeding to them, but there was more money. It looked like this was before the election that he, had promised would come. Is there any hope for anything like that? So private donations, and do you see a change from Washington? That's all.
Okay. Great question, caller. Private donations, absolutely, both materials as well as monetary. And that can be mail to 201 East Park Street, Champaign, Illinois, 61820. Or you can call the Boys and Girls Club to receive more information, 355-5437. In regards to the Obama administration, there are a lot of things out there, but many things have been around newness, new efforts. Like, for example, we're part of a collaboration for the broadband initiative. It could have significance of millions and millions of dollars, could be about job creation and infrastructure. But the question is, how do you sustain efforts like that? What we really have to kind of think about is we have several agencies that have a track record for a number of years that already have a mode of operation and that are doing well. Of course, everyone can do better. How do we sustain those operations versus applying more pressure to do new things? Now, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of things that we have on our whiteboard that we would like to do new. But it has to be the right time and have the right funding behind it so we can sustain it. So we try to be very cautious about how we go about looking in new endeavors, because sometimes these can be short term and we can't sustain them and we have to close them down or get rid of the program. So that's kind of it's a tricky situation, but we are looking at a lot of different things. You know, we're looking at foundations. We're looking at how we can do our local fundraising better, how we can do local awareness and marketing and education better also.
Yeah. We're come to the end of the time here. We're going to have to finish up. I'm assuming also that if people are interested in giving time, you would be happy to talk to them about that.
Absolutely. Volunteers are always welcome. We get probably about 150 to 180 volunteers a year that comes in and work with the kids. You can also work on a volunteer basis with committees. It's just a variety of ways. But once again, our phone number at the Boys and Girls Club is 355-5437. Thank you for having us on the show and give us the opportunity to talk about the Boys and Girls Club and the climate of social services in our community. And in closing, I would just like to say I've worked in a lot of communities, and I'm telling you, we have a fine portfolio of social services, and I think they work great in concert with our municipalities as well as our government officials and leaders. We have to continue to be cognitive that none of these institutions can stay around without having the support of the individual investor.
Yeah.
And now more than ever that, you know, you talk about if you give a dollar to something, that it has impact. It really does. And so I'd also like to give a big thanks out to Nathan, Salt and Light. Nathan runs Salt and Light. His family was chosen on the home makeover, and Salt and Light does a great job also in the community. So, then once again, thank you for having us out.
Well, thanks again, Andre Arrington. He's the executive director of the Don Moyer Boys and Girls Club in Champaign. And again, if you'd like to find out more about what we've been doing in connection with this series on the economy, just take a look at the website we're working on putting together. It's willconnect.org/economy.